Hopefully, we all learn something. And if not, at least you'll get a chuckle at my ability to mess things up. Ready? Let's do this. Welcome to my somewhat motivational, somewhat humorous, but very reasonably priced book, Fail Until You Don't. And you're listening to the audiobook right now. Thanks for buying the audiobook. By the way, with my last book, I thought the audiobook was just part of the deal, meaning I'd have to read for hours and hours and hours as part of my contract. Nope. They paid me extra to read the audiobook. Boom! Bonus! Here's to a positive attitude and this audiobook and me getting paid. What are your fighting words? There isn't anything earth-shattering about these three words, fight, grind, and repeat. They're just words that work for me, like a mantra. I say them out loud at times when I'm just not feeling it, or when the alarm goes off, and I didn't get to sleep until midnight the night before. I say them before a single eye opens. I believe in them. If they work for you too, go for it. Use them. I'm not going to sue you. But maybe you just aren't feeling them. If not, find three other words that work for you. Take out your smartphone, your computer, your pad, your paper, whatever is easiest for you to put ideas down. Brainstorm a bunch of words for each category. Maybe less negative words work for you, like dream, hard work, revision, or maybe you go for humor. Crap, crappier, crappiest. The actual words don't matter. It's the concepts behind them. Whatever words stick in your head and stay in your heart are the ones you should use to know that you'll be bad at stuff when you first start out and that you shouldn't stop pursuing your dreams. In other words, it's okay to suck. Just don't give up. Just a warning. This book is going to seem really negative at times. And at times, it's going to be quite inspirational. I struggle with balance in my life. And you could argue with me about every single point in this book, because in the end, we're all wrong all the time. I mean, see how negative that sounds? Get ready for a master class in Bobby's life theory, and it does feel weird to say that in third person. Part 1, Fight. Chapter 1, What is the Fight? I exercise a lot. I try to do it for at least an hour, 5-6 days a week. And I hate exercising. It's the worst. There's not a moment of working out where I think, oh, this is just fine. Nope. Torture. Every minute. For me, it's like waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning, something I've done for the last 14 years. Thanks to the fact that I do a national morning radio show, I hate waking up before the crack of dawn. I hate it. But I do it because otherwise I wouldn't get to keep my radio show. So the long-term payoff is way nicer than the momentary pain. It's the same with working out. The feeling of muscle exhaustion and mental victory when I'm done is so much better than the pain that I went through to get there. Plus, working out's how I maintain my girlish figure. But because I exercise a lot and hate it, I'm always on the lookout for new workouts. I've tried everything from jogging to lifting to spending all my money on those Billy Blanks DVDs. Yeah. I was once an avid Tae Bo disciple, which I may add, made me quite popular with the middle-aged moms I worked out with at the gym in my apartment complex. I'll do something a ton, get bored, and then move on. Bored was the state I was in when, several months ago, I noticed a boxing gym near where I live in Nashville. I didn't know anyone at the gym or anything about it, but I decided to give it a go. Trained as I am in the Blanks method of martial arts on steroids, my hands are lethal weapons. Okay, not really, but I figured the gym would probably be a lot of other moms toning their arms and taking their frustrations out in the ring. It's my kind of place. I called the number in the window one weekend and said, hey, I want to come in and box. What I didn't realize when I made an appointment was that I had booked a one-on-one session with a boxing coach. I thought I was signing up for a group class with the ladies. Instead, I met a former trainer of pro boxers and other professional athletes, which, by the way, he looked like he could be one himself. Boxing was the hardest physical activity I'd ever done, and I was immediately hooked, obviously. Although, don't get me wrong, I still prefer the after I'm done feeling to before I started my workout. I immediately booked 3 sessions, then 9, then 20. Ever since I walked into that gym, I've been boxing so much that I'm now considering opening a gym on my own. And if you know anything about me, you know that I'm a person of extremes. you're probably wondering what makes boxing so great, particularly for a guy who isn't fond of physical exertion and only brags about going to beat downtown. Simply put, boxing is a challenge, and I like to be challenged. Whether it's performing on stage, interviewing famous musicians, or exercising, I actually enjoy the uncomfortable feeling when something is unfamiliar and hard enough to make me consider quitting. And boxing, if nothing else, is really hard. It's by far the most grueling exercise I've ever done, and I've done them all. I did an Olympic distance triathlon, cheated during a marathon, got into the cult of CrossFit, considered myself a recreational bodybuilder, stretched it out in yoga. Well, that's not all of them, but it's a lot. And boxing is the most mentally and physically taxing of them all. Before I got into the ring, I thought the sport was just about who can punch each other in the face the most. Now I understand it's about muscular strength, cardiovascular endurance, agility, strategy, and pain tolerance. I'm not a boxer. I'm not even pretending to be one. Come on, I'm skinny, I wear glasses. I'm never going to get in the ring and try to fight another human in any kind of real way. When I talk about training, I'm not paying money for someone to punch me in the face 50 times. The goal isn't to front that I'm something I'm not or lose any teeth. I saved a long time to pay for these teeth, which were once terrible due to the fact that when I was a kid growing up poor in Arkansas, the dentist was as foreign of a concept as the Queen of England. Since earning a decent paycheck, I've become quite acquainted with the field of dentistry. My teeth right now, I know you can't see them, but they are amazing. And I have no shame whatsoever for telling you they are bought and paid for. Shout out to Dr. Cutbirth. This was not a paid shout out, by the way, although maybe I can get some sort of rebate by throwing that name out there. Anyway, back to boxing. The kind of boxing I do means I won't lose my teeth, but I can still take some pretty nasty blows that result in big old bruises. In order to avoid getting hurt in the ring, even in the mildest of training sessions, the ones that are over an hour of nonstop cardio with added weights and core work thrown in and barely time to get a drink of water or towel off your eyeballs covered in sweat, even in those, you have to work not only your conditioning and footwork, but also how to best position your body to minimize the impact of your opponent's punches. Because, just like in life, you're going to get hit. So you need to plant your body at the right angle so you're only grazed instead of absorbing a full shot to the nose. How do you put yourself in the best position to succeed? That's the question. And that's not just my boxing coach talking. That is the perfect metaphor for the fight. It begins with setting up the right foundation so you can feel your strongest. I'm constantly working on my footwork and rhythm whenever I'm in the ring, which isn't all that different from how I think about my regular life. Whether it's being on time for work or how I talk to people in meetings, these are disciplined, small actions that become the sum total of my behavior. Each step counts, even if they're easily forgotten or dismissed for a million different reasons. Maintaining your stamina and confidence is that much harder when you get punched in the side of the head. No one wants to get into a fight and be outmaneuvered, but it happens. When hits are coming at you quickly, how do you regain your composure and find the spot where you can take a punch and turn it back over again? Like Mike Tyson said, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. Whether it's boxing, work, or love, my plan is to always plan to get punched in the mouth. In my life, when my radio show has bad ratings, a theater full of people don't laugh at a joke, or another relationship falls apart, boy, there have been a lot of those, it feels like I'm getting punched in the face. During those times, I deflect the shot as much as I can, learn from it, and use that knowledge to my advantage. That, to me, is the fight. It's all about the fight. Fighting is usually thought of as a bad thing. When you're a kid, your parents and teachers tell you not to fight, and they get mad at you if you do. As an adult, there are folks whom everything's a fight. You know, the guy who honks his horn at you as soon as the light turns green, then speeds up alongside your car to make sure you fully understand how much he doesn't appreciate your driving skills right before he cuts in front of you. Like that kind of guy. Or the person who sends back every dish at a restaurant, blaming the poor waiter or waitress for never getting it right. Constantly battling the entire world because you have some deeper issue you're not facing is no way to live. That's exhausting for you and everyone that you come into contact with. And it's not the kind of fighting I'm talking about. My kind of fight isn't negativity. It's about survival. It's in my DNA. It all goes back to that small, poor kid who grew up in a small, poor town, just trying to keep his head above water. Fighting might have been part of my nature from birth, but it was also how I nurtured myself into something better than what I was born into. Socioeconomically, I had to work extra hard to catch my peers. I had to have jobs before anyone else my age. I'm not bragging that I was some kind of business genius. I didn't create a state-of-the-art lemonade stand or invent the gluten-free Bitcoin. I was just out raking leaves as soon as school was over until it got dark. Nope, I was never the one with the brilliant idea. I was just the one out there doing anything that I could for a dollar. Money wasn't the only area of struggle. Physically, I also had to do more than just meet the average. Athletically, I was never the fastest runner, never had the best hands, nor could I hit the ball the farthest. Heck, only have one working eyeball. My right eye only sees light. My right eye has never been able to perceive color or any real definition, so at this point my brain doesn't even try. I wore a patch as a kid to try to fix it, but no dice. Hence my life of cheating on those driving tests that we talked about earlier. I made up for my lack of visual depth perception and puny frame by putting in hours and hours and hours of training. I would get to practice first, or beg to get in the field house to work out even if we didn't have practice. The effort paid off. I was drafted third overall by the Chicago Cubs in the 1999 baseball draft. Boom. Also, ha, I'm kidding. But I was an all-conference first baseman and named to the all-district tournament team as well as defensive player of the year. And don't get me started on my football accolades, because mostly there aren't many. I've always felt like I had to work harder in life, and despite all that's gone right, I still feel that way. I'm constantly fighting to improve. Every day is a fight to get ahead. There are the internal fights with myself, to prepare the best show possible, to land jokes funnier for my stand-up act, to write better songs for my band. There are also my constant fights with the rest of the world, with others who want to take my job, with others who want to beat me in the ratings or just generally to see me fail. My battles are not only self-interested. I also fight for the causes that I'm passionate about. St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, which treats kids with cancer and other life-threatening diseases. There's also the Andy Roddick Foundation, launched by my good friend Andy, which gives children from disadvantaged backgrounds awesome after-school experiences. And Austin Pets Alive, a no-kill animal shelter that does amazing work in Central Texas. I might not be the most articulate defender of these organizations, but I'll be the loudest, screaming on the radio, from the stage, in interviews, or from the pages of my books. Enthusiasm is my way of combating the fact that I'm never the most talented, smartest, or anythingest person in the room or profession. I was just recently inducted into the National Radio Hall of Fame at age 37, which made me the youngest member in the organization's history. And I started my speech with these exact words. I'm not the est person at anything. I didn't say a word, just est. Now that I think about it, I don't know if that made sense to anybody but me. My mediocrity has only become more obvious as I've gained a little bit of fame and entered arenas where everyone and their uncle are endowed with incredible gifts. Take awesome artist Walker Hayes, who for my band The Raging Idiots co-wrote with me and produced the song Namaste, which was the number one comedy song for weeks on the Billboard chart. Working with him in the studio, I couldn't keep up with how his brain processed music. It was like listening to someone speak a language that I didn't even know existed. I didn't get defensive or freaked out when all I could do was sit like a dummy by Walker's side as he worked his magic. I'm able to enjoy myself in moments like that because I've had a lot of practice. I'm used to being out of my depth, which happens all the time. It's a natural byproduct of constantly trying to get better. I was definitely out of my league when I did podcasts with John Mayer and the songwriter and record producer Busby. These two guys went on about philosophy and art in a way that made it clear they were on a totally different plane than me intellectually. Although I pride myself on having learned a lot about music and culture from my surroundings, moments like when John Mayer described the sounds, tones, and overall recording of the song Gravity, that blew my mind. Where I just heard a good song, he heard the micro details that come from having a hyper-trained and talented ear. As confused as I might have been, I was just happy to hear experts talk in a way they would only talk to other experts. It was as if someone got to an advanced level of Mario Brothers and then handed me the controller. I wasn't good enough at the video game to actually get there myself, But to experience something like what the super pro gamers got to feel, now that was freaking cool. Fighter in the spotlight, Walker Hayes. This talented singer-songwriter is the dictionary definition of a fighter. After his two debut singles did not do what his record company had hoped they would, he was dropped by his label. Meanwhile, his wife Lainey was pregnant with their fifth child. The music business does not care how many mouths you have to feed. If you don't hit the charts high, that's it. Game over. So Walker took a job doing the graveyard shift at Costco. His hours, 4 a.m. to 10 a.m., meant he could still pursue his dreams during regular business hours. While he struggled paying the mortgage, he also struggled with alcoholism. Eventually, not only did he get sober, but he used that struggle as inspiration for one of his songs called Beer in the Fridge, and that got him signed to a new label and named one of Rolling Stone's 2017 10 New Country Artists You Need to Know. Walker said the following, "I draw strength from a bunch of stuff. The example I want to set for my kids. The husband I want to be to my wife. The son I want to be for my parents. The singer-songwriter I want to be for this town. The man I want to be for myself." Walker goes on and says, "I've been given gifts, and it's my responsibility to share them in order to leave this world better than I found it." Walker says, "I feel like life should be spelled F-I-G-H-T. Success and sobriety aren't all they're cracked up to be. Success just makes me want more success. And even though I'm not getting messed up, I'm still pretty messed up. It's always a fight." All right, back to me, Bobby here. I'm never the guy who tries to be intimidating because of my skills or my good looks, ladies. Yeah. All right, you can stop laughing at that one. I'm just the guy who shows up. If I have any talent at all, it's the willingness to fight. But I don't even know that I can call it a talent since I've worked on that too. I pride myself on not being the best. Never have been. Everything and anything I'm halfway decent at now, I really sucked at some point during my career. Sometimes I continue to suck and still do. Case in point, my radio career. I have a job where I make a great living talking, and I'm not even a good speaker. I speak in broken sentences. I speak too fast. My speech pattern is technically bad. I've read reports from professionals, and they say I don't speak in a professional way. And yes, I get paid, handsomely I may add, to talk to millions of people every morning. It might seem counterintuitive, but because I'm not naturally good at stuff, I have to make my presence bigger whenever I try something I want to do. I have to try harder and make the stakes higher when I put myself out there. Don't believe me? How about this? I get paid to sing. I can't sing. My band, The Raging Idiots, is one of my coolest examples of what you can do when you engage in the fight. I started my band, The Raging Idiots, as a teenager with some friends in high school. Our band's original name was The Concubines, but we were told to change it if we wanted to play at local churches and family-friendly events. We were fine with that. We didn't even know what concubine meant at the time. We were idiots. The first incarnation of the band fizzled after people actually saw us play and realized, yeah, we sucked as much as people thought we would. I brought The Raging Idiots back as an accompanying band to my stand-up comedy act. Bobby Bones and his hilarious band, The Raging Idiots, wound up being me doing 7 minutes of bad comedy, and then, after grabbing a guitar, becoming a one-man, one-instrument band. The rest of the band was always sick. Or they were on tour with Lou Bega, who at the time had Mambo No. 5, and that was a huge song. I reappropriated the name of my high school band whenever I wrote song parodies or spoofs that I played on my radio show with my producer Eddie on guitar and backing vocals. The audience reaction was good enough that I dreamed up a plan to make The Raging Idiots a legitimate band. Smash cut! 4 years later, we have a number one comedy record, a number one kids record, a top five country album. We're playing main slots at major festivals. We're headlining big theaters. We're making millions for charity. And did I mention that I'm a C-plus singer at best? By the way, that's up from the D-plus level I started at. I've not only worked hard to improve my singing, but I've surrounded myself with awesomer people. Pro tip, this is a must. Drop your ego and put better people around you. So how did I turn my parody playing group with a lousy frontman into a band that sells out shows to thousands of people? The success of The Raging Idiots goes back to how we started by playing the kind of bars where people don't need the music to be good to enjoy it. The audience, and I do use that term audience generously, might not have cared if we were funny or in tune, but from the first Raging Idiots concert, I was convinced I could market our group into something much bigger than it was. I might have been rocking out in a back room of burrito place, but I was captivated by the idea of creating an act worth seeing by convincing people it was worth seeing. I knew if I could get momentum going through excitement, our band would rise to the challenge by improving as we went along. The Raging Idiots was my version of a science experiment with the added benefit of doing some good for good causes. From the moment that I committed to this concept, I wanted to figure out how I could make my band seem much cooler than it really was and get bigger as fast as possible. It wasn't about money at the time. All of that was going to charity. Remember, I come from a family with serious addiction issues. While I might not drink or do drugs, I have the same drive for wanting more and more and more. This drive can be used for good or evil. I hope that I choose the good way more often than not. Now back to my rock and roll master plan. What I did was book these tiny rooms, 50 person maximum capacity tiny, simply because I knew they'd sell out immediately. This wasn't an exercise in ego boosting. I knew our sold out shows had nothing to do with our talent and everything to do with the size of the room. It was a marketing ploy. If I brought home the message that we were selling out, it didn't matter how small the venues, just that we were selling out. I kept ratcheting up the size bit by bit. We graduated from 100 capacity rooms to 200 and so on until today. We're playing 2,000 to 3,000 person venues. Now that I've achieved my goal of growing the audience of the Raging Idiots, I've lived up to my original promise to myself of actually becoming a really good band. Because we kept selling out the festival and theater dates we booked, promoters kept giving us bigger and more prominent venues. The proof was in the ticket sales. The success of the radio show has helped with promotion, and we've gotten better, but in my estimation, we're still not as good as the huge stages that we play. So the new fight for me is figuring out how to grow into our rooms. The fight, a quality I've been blessed with and nurtured into an amazing tool, is a way to level the playing field of life. You may think I'm the unfunniest guy on earth and worst musician. You may hate my radio show and my politics. You may think I'm stupid and stupid looking. But the one thing nobody can say about me is that I was born with an easy pass to life. When I started my career in a radio market so small that it was unranked, it was a huge achievement for me. I knew no one and had no money. Every move I made was a risk. Some of my gambles failed and a lot didn't. But no matter, for over a decade, I always showed up for 12, 14, 18-hour workdays. Maybe you weren't born on third base either, and maybe you were, but for whatever reason, you don't feel like it. I've learned as my life has evolved that it's never not a struggle. I know people who have $100 million, and even for them, it's never not a struggle. Sure, they have different issues than people who don't know how they're going to make their mortgage payment month to month, but believe me, everyone has stuff. The sooner you embrace this truth, the sooner you can leave behind the bitterness of what you don't have and start trying to get what you want. The fight is a way to do something about your stuff. Whether it's leveling the playing field or beating the competition, there's nothing better for overcoming hopelessness than digging in and just getting to work. Every day, everyone's fighting to survive and be more. And it's not negative. It's not a fist fight because you're angry. It's not a punch in the face. It's doing whatever is necessary, no matter the outcome. It's a sharpening, a constant and wonderful struggle, much like my boxing classes, where if I don't prove that I want it enough, I'm not even allowed in the ring. According to my trainer, I have to work at a high level enough for the privilege of getting into the ring for more punishment. Does that even make sense? I have to show up, kill myself conditioning for 45 minutes, and if I've worked hard enough, I'm permitted in the ring for the chance to vomit my guts out. If that sounds like a win to you, well, then you understand the fight. The fight is, these are words that I use to describe the fight. And so what I want you to do is also think of your own. And if you want to stop the audiobook and jot a few down or put them on your phone screen, that's cool. But these are words that I use when it's time to talk about the fight. Words like struggle, work, reflection, passion, hope, advantage, challenge, victory, failure, accomplishment. Those are my words. Those are my words that trigger the fight. And I hope you come up with a list for you to do the same. Chapter 2. What are you fighting for? If people keep saying no and you keep wanting it, that's the definition of fight worthy. A friend of mine, a successful executive, decided that since her two kids were off to college and out of the house, she finally had a little time to pursue something she had always wanted to do, painting. Not house painting, but the kind you put a lovely frame around. This is a lady who, I have no doubt, could pretty much do whatever she sets her mind to. Well, being a lover of the arts, she decided she wanted to paint pictures. So she bought paintbrushes, paints, canvas, an easel, and she put the whole setup in the most beautiful sunroom that you can imagine, with the most perfect lighting and all manner of artistic inspiration right there. She even hired an art teacher to come to her house once a week to give her some instruction. She was all in. Problem was, she never painted, ever. When, at a business meeting in her office, I asked her how her painting was going, she answered in her typically blunt style, "I never do it." Despite having vast resources at her disposal and talking about taking up the hobby for years and years, she explained that the paintbrushes and canvas just sat there untouched. She felt guilty every time she walked by them, so much so that what had once been her favorite room in the house, she had turned into a place she hated. After creeping around her extra room for a couple of months, she finally faced the simple fact that if I really wanted to do it, I'd do it. She's absolutely right. Now, this example might seem kind of trivial, but it gets to the heart of a major stumbling block in fighting for what you want, and that's figuring out what you want. People tend to romanticize their goals. Whether it's learning to paint or making a lot of money, at times we think we want things that down deep, we really don't want. Goals can seem important because of our parents, or sexy because of the people we follow on Instagram. Did you always want to be a dentist? Or are you in dental school because that's what your dad does? By the way, I'm not talking about you, Dr. Cobert, who hooked me up with these teeth. I know dentistry is your calling. You're a genius. Can I get a little rebate now? Do you really want that huge house with more dormers than Dracula's castle? Or is it just that everyone in your town wants a McMansion of their own? By the way, those huge lawns, they are murder to maintain. I know, because I've been fined at least 30 times by my homeowners association, and I'm never even home to enjoy my house. It can be hard to separate yourself. Everyone gets sucked into false goals, me included. My "I don't really want to do this" goal was to play piano. I didn't expect to become Jerry Lee Lewis, which, by the way, I laugh out loud as I write that analogy, because I could have said John Legend, or Alicia Keys, or Elton John. But nope, I immediately went with a guy from the days of black and white TV who also married his cousin. But I did want to become decent enough to perform on stage. I tried. I took lessons. I practiced for a while. Soon, however, I was blowing off both. Everything new is challenging at the beginning. And as I said, I typically love a challenge. But with piano, it was different. As soon as it got frustrating, I told myself, "I'm no good." And then I quit. But I'm usually not put off by sucking at something. Sucking at something has never kept me from going after it, never when it's a real priority. My actions, or lack of action, proved that piano wasn't a true goal. Despite what I told myself, it turned out that I really didn't want to play like Jerry Lee Lewis or marry my cousin. Unfortunately, we can only prioritize so much. It's impossible to do 11 different things at once, at least not at a high level. That's because time is limited, unless you're stoned, or so I've been told. I'm still waiting to try that. If I ever do, which I probably won't, I think I'll definitely go the edible route. Do they make weed in Werther's Original? That'd be crazy and awesome. Figuring out what's truly important to you, and not to your mother or first cousin or significant other or dog, is the first step to the fight. And it's worth spending a little time up front on sorting through your motivations and fantasies in order to keep you from wasting a whole lot of time later. Fight equals time plus work. What's worth fighting for and what's not? The question is, Do I really want this? That's not an easy question to answer. Painting and playing the piano can be seen as superficial examples. When my executive friend and I gave up on our passion projects, they had very little bearing on our lives. Some decisions, like getting married, having children, or pursuing a particular career, carry a ton of weight. But the questions you need to ask yourself are the same, whether you're choosing to play tennis or quit your job. For me, figuring out the career part of my life has always been straightforward. There has never not been a time in my life where I didn't have a clear vision of my dream job. It's always been a national morning radio show and a TV talk show like my hero David Letterman. Every step I make, from comedy to music to writing, is a step in the direction of that goal. That doesn't mean I've always gotten what I wanted or even know how to get it, but I've always known what I want. And as I said, that's the first step in this whole fight thing. My personal life? Well, that's a whole other story. Despite all the wonderful women I've dated and the therapy I've had, I still don't know what I want. The way I grew up with a mom whose addictions were so bad that I was adopted by my grandmother, it created conflicts that are hard to get over. Yeah, by the way, I've had a lot of therapy. In some ways, I recognize that my drive when it comes to work is a function of the fact that I can't figure out how to get love and give love like a normal person. So escaping into work is a defense mechanism at times. I perform every day, whether it's on a microphone or on stage, I perform. Why the maniacal need to sing, dance, act like a fool for others all the time? When it comes down to it, and I mean, it really comes down to it, like therapy down to it, I'm just looking for love from others. We all are in our own ways. Although no one has actually cornered the market on the proper way to find and reciprocate love, some people undoubtedly have healthier methods than others. I have a friend who is overly kind. Is that even a thing, you may be asking to yourself? Yes, it is. 100%. He's the guy who's trying to buy everybody's meal at every dinner in a way that's so over the top that you don't even want to go out with him. Or he's late to his kid's recital because he was at his friend's kid's recital. He's so nice that he actually makes his own life worse. You're not doing good, I said in a talk with him. I said, you're doing harm to yourself. I think love is why everybody does everything. But you must figure out if your fight is for what you love or what you're doing for love. That's an important distinction. As human beings, our number one instinct is to find love. But that's different than having a purpose and a plan. It's not easy to completely untangle this. And that's why therapy costs so much and takes so long. But you can ask yourself one important and clear question. Is my fight good for me? To find the true answer, nothing beats some deep down soul searching. I'm talking to you millennials. Pick your heads up from Instagram and finish this sentence. But only after you follow me. At Mr. Bobby Bones on Instagram. Yeah, hit me up. There is no substitute for reflecting on your actions and feelings and how the two interact. The power of no, a shortcut to figuring out what you want. If you're 20-something and rolling your eyes right now, just know that I also rolled my eyes when I heard older people tell me the exact same thing about the importance of reflection and experience in finding your path. And now, here I am repeating it. It's the natural cycle of things. But fine, if you want a simple life hack, here you go. If you keep being told no, and you continue to keep trying for it, that's how you know that you really want it. Put another way, if someone saying no to you doesn't make you want your goal any less, then you're following the right goal. Even in an industry, show business, known for rejection, I've been turned down an absurd amount of times. I'd say 25 no's to one yes is an accurate average for me. Those stats are brutal, and yet I've never thought about quitting. It's a weird thing. When people repeatedly say no, I keep going. I think, okay, I must really want this. Otherwise, why would I put myself through so much abuse? You can ask yourself the very same question. You don't need to have a PhD to know if you're going for something that's good or cool but doesn't feel right. If you're pursuing what you want, and you're not getting any satisfaction, or worse, if you're feeling awful, you have to take a step back for a second. It won't be comfortable to question your motivations, but it won't kill you either. The process of deliberation is especially necessary when you're heading into murky areas of your life. For me, As I said, that's relationships. While I totally know my mind about business, with women, my head isn't always screwed on right. I've pursued girlfriends who were fun, pretty, smart, nice, successful, but that doesn't mean they were right for me. Or me for them, as I'm sure they'd attest to. What's perfect on paper isn't what's perfect in real life. That's not only true for matters of the heart, but for careers, friendships, even what you want to eat for lunch. Unfortunately, to figure it out, you got to go through a lot of making the wrong decisions for the wrong reasons. That's the learning process of growing up. It would be great if you'd known what you needed to do back before you needed to start doing it, but unless you have a time-traveling DeLorean, by the way, old reference that you youngsters may not get, move along from my contemporaries. Let me get that fist bump for that Michael J. Fox shout-out. So yeah, unless you're time-traveling, it ain't gonna happen. Sometimes you have to go through a lot of relationships to find the right one, or try a lot of jobs until you find the right one that you're passionate about. Fighter in the Spotlight, Amy Brown. Well, it's a real treat for you out there listening to this audiobook because Amy is in the studio now.
Hey.
So we're going to feature you. You ready?
Okay, I'm ready.
More than 5 years ago, my co-host Amy was on a mission trip to Haiti where she visited an orphanage and fell in love with a little boy whom she couldn't stop thinking about when she returned home to Nashville. Is that true?
100%. I remember going home, not being able to sleep, and telling my husband, I cannot stop thinking about this kid.
Amy and her husband, who were having trouble conceiving, returned to Port-au-Prince.
Do you remember giving me off work to take that trip to go back and see if we could get him?
No.
Yeah.
I remember giving you off a lot of days, so I don't remember those specific days.
I was at yoga with your girlfriend at the time, and then the next day you gave me off of work, and my husband and I flew to Haiti.
Well, look at me.
Yeah, you're so nice.
Yeah, I'm a real treat, yeah. So they went to Port-au-Prince to meet the 2-year-old boy again, whom they immediately decided to adopt, along with a 5-year-old girl.
Now, she wasn't immediate, but she was probably about 6 months after that.
Well, they might have started the process immediately, but there's nothing immediate about the process. Amy spent years doing paperwork, paying tens of thousands of dollars.
True that.
Completing lots of home visits, background checks, and other security reviews, and becoming their legal parent. And she still had trouble getting her kids home. It was heartbreaking for everyone, huh?
Yeah. Fun fact, we had to get our fingerprints taken every single year, twice a year, to prove we were still not criminals. So, did it 5 times.
Her kids suffered, but so did Amy. There were times when she broke down. Man, there were a lot of times when you broke down.
It wasn't some.
I probably didn't even see a quarter of the times.
Oh, yeah. No, it was pretty bad.
But there were many more where she should have, and she didn't. Instead of getting down or depressed, Amy constantly corresponded with government agencies, cheered her kids up over FaceTime, and visited Haiti, where the show and our listeners have supported the children's orphanage and also created a bakery that offers both food and jobs for a lot of folks in need.
Yeah, that bakery is up and running. It's kind of crazy to go back to the orphanage and visit there and like see the our listeners and how amazing it was to have that. But I mean, we care about all the kids there. And so going back to Haiti was bittersweet because I loved seeing them, but then it was so hard to leave them.
How Amy functioned every single day, refusing to give up no matter how frustrating things got. Well, that's a fight. She never thought this process would take as long as it did. Still, she wouldn't stop fighting.
No, I definitely thought it was going to take 2 years. I remember when it started, I thought, 2 years. And then after 2 years, I was like, okay, 6 more months. And I was like, a few more months. And then when it got to 5 years, a year before the kids came home, practically, we had our adoption shower because I thought the kids were coming any day now.
Amy said, even if it had taken 10 years, we would never have given up on them.
That's true.
Amy said, 2 little humans were depending on us. When things seemed hopeless, I prayed for more faith in the process. How could we ever walk away and give up on something we had asked for?
There are times I thought, are we going to have to move to Haiti? Because I desperately wanted them to just be in a loving home with a mom and a dad. And I thought, we might have to go to Haiti to make sure that that happens.
Amy relied on her husband, family, friends, and faith to get her through the hard times. She also hung pictures of her kids as a constant reminder to never lose hope.
Yeah, right when you walk in our house, like there's 6 huge frames that line the hallway. And they're pictures of them because I wanted to walk in every day and be like, one day, this will be their home. I did not want to give up hope on that.
Yeah, you said you had their faces up in the hallway a year before they actually got there because that was going to be their home too.
I know. People would come over and they'd be like, oh, are these your kids? Where are they? I was like, oh, they're in Haiti, but I'm just hanging them on the wall. It's sort of like my vision board, if you will.
Finally, roughly 5 years after she found the children, she was able to bring them home.
They're truly a gift, one that we had to work hard for, but a gift nonetheless. And I thank Jesus for them every day. Even though it's like I was pregnant for 60 months instead of 9 months, it all worked out.
I'm glad you weren't pregnant for 60 months just from having to be with you every day.
Yeah, that'd be pretty bad. But yeah, no, I gave birth to like a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old.
Well, and that's why you're a fighter in the spotlight. That's an awesome story. And thanks for being on my audiobook.
Thanks for having me.
I'm not paying you.
So I'm doing this for free.
You're doing this for free. And if you do a book, I'll hop on your audiobook.
Okay.
Okay.
Do I have to pay you?
Obviously. Duh.
Oh, duh. Yeah. Okay.
What is your fight? What do you want to not suck at? What are you willing to fail at so much that you embarrass yourself? What will you do anything for? Here are some questions and exercises to get you thinking about the fight and whether it's really the right one for you. If you're still searching for your fight, what moments in the past have made you the happiest? They can be small or big ones, or even certain periods of time. Don't overthink this. Just see what comes to mind. These are questions you can return to over and over whenever you're having doubts. What makes you the happiest? What was it about that time that made you so happy? Is the essence of that time something you can recreate now? For example, if the happiest time of your life was summers, working outdoors as a kid, but you now have a desk job that's killing you, maybe try volunteering at a local park or outdoor recreational area to see if you can recapture some of that feeling. Volunteering or a part-time job is a great way to make incremental change without upending your whole life. What are you passionate about doing? Be honest. Even if it's eating in restaurants, that might be a big clue as to a job you'd be passionate about. What percentage of your day, week, month do you spend devoted to your passions? Is that enough for you? If not, how could you increase it? And what areas of your life need a lot of work? Relationships with family members, dating, losing weight. Those are classic ones. What specifically relates to you? How much control do you have over the situation? And what, if anything, could you do no matter how difficult to improve it? If you have a fight, but you want a gut check on it, when you think about doing the thing you're fighting for, what do you feel? Does your stomach knot up? Or do you just not want to listen to this anymore and get back to it? If you're a procrastinator or are scared to put yourself out there to achieve your dreams, what's holding you back? Is it fear of failure or something less intuitive? Maybe the odd fear of success? Where do your dreams and goals come from? If they are yours, when did you first conjure them up? Does anyone else you know have the same fight? If so, why? If you've succeeded at your goal, where will it take you in 5 years? How about 10 years? What's the pinnacle of that path? Picture yourself there and see if you like it. My biggest failure, Chris Stapleton. Chris Stapleton. Man, he's awesome. He's written hit songs for everyone from Adele to Luke Bryan. He's won multiple Grammy and CMA awards as an artist. He's been coming on my radio show since long before he became seriously famous. He's not only a cool guy, but someone I've developed a personal relationship with over the years. Chris says this. The day that my dad passed away, I was in South Carolina, taking my kids to the beach with their other grandparents. I got the call. My brother called. So I took a little walk, kind of soaked that in. You know, I had seen my dad 2 days prior. We had played a show near where he lived, and he told me goodbye or whatever. I could have stayed over. I could have figured something out. But I used some lame excuse, like, I gotta get on the bus because it's leaving. That was a failure. I don't have many regrets, but I do regret those 2 missed days. For some reason, those 2 days magically mean more than all the other days that I could have been there saying hello or doing something with my dad. That was a failure as a son, I guess. You can't get those things back, but you can learn to try not to let the professional outweigh the personal or steer it more than it should. That, for me, was the lesson. Chapter 3. Find someone who tells you that you suck. Yeah, you read that right. I want you to actually go out and seek people who will say to your face, you're not good. Now, I don't mean someone on Facebook or Twitter. People on the internet actually think you suck already. Go ahead, ask them. I'm describing what some call constructive criticism, or what I like to think of as your coach in the corner of the ring as you fight. Someone looking out for you from all angles. The best example of this in my life is my comedy gigs. As I talk to you now, I just wrapped up a weekend doing stand-up in Modesto and Monterey, California. As a matter of fact, I've been on the road most of my weekends this year doing stand-up, slowly growing as a comedian from super mediocre to somewhat stomachable. Let me back up. I've loved comedy ever since I was a kid. Watching my hero David Letterman on TV, Late Night with David Letterman was the one thing that I look forward to every single night. It was a constant for me. Now that I do comedy myself, I love it even more. I love the pressure to bring joy to others. I love the torture of it. Think about this. You're walking up on a stage, alone, with the goal of entertaining a crowd, with words and movements alone. And by the way, they didn't get in for free, so you'd better be pretty freaking funny. I love all of it. The blinding lights, the expectation, the challenge, and simply making people feel good. Comedy is something I'll never be great at or even be good at. But that's what's awesome about it. I love the chase of a successful joke, especially when the odds are you're not going to nail it. Let me tell you a bit of my story of comedy tragedy and triumph and how this can relate to whatever the fight is in your life. I don't think anyone thought I was serious when I said I wanted to pursue a legit career as a comedian. I wasn't talking about doing little spots here or there like I've done for years, but headlining. People listened to me on the radio or watched me online or came to watch my band, but the odds of them to pay $50 for a ticket to watch me stand alone and tell jokes wasn't good. My journey in proving these odds wrong, or die on stage, started at the end of 2016. In my management's office, surrounded by my team, we were in a meeting to plan my 2017 schedule and goals. By the way, let me say this. I've always felt that it's pretty pretentious to talk about your team, aka your agents and managers and lawyers. But now that I live in that bubble, they're absolute. Let me sidestep for a second from my tale of comedic glory and explain how my life works with all these random people who I've nicknamed the percentages. I call them that because each one of these fine professionals gets a percentage of what I earn. I'll introduce you to them. My manager. She manages all aspects of my career, and for that, gets 15% of everything I make, straight up, before taxes. My agent, he and she, finds jobs for me and gets 10% of whatever I make. My business manager, she handles all my money and gets 2.5% of my earnings. If you do the math, that's 27.5% of my money that comes right off the top to pay for my team. Take out taxes, and for every dollar I make, I'm really getting about 40 cents. That's how it works in showbiz, folks. So I'm in an office where all my percentages were gathered. I made an announcement. Listen up, everybody. I want to headline a stand-up comedy tour. There, I said it. That's always one of the first steps of the fight for me, saying it aloud. More on making your goals concrete coming up in chapter 6. I could tell by the way their mouths hung open, and the one guy who shook his head, that they thought I was nuts. Not because I don't say dumb things from time to time or take big chances all the time. The people who work with me are totally used to that. But to headline a stand-up comedy tour of 1,000 to 2,000 seat theaters across America is insane for an unproven comedian, especially for me. Theaters aren't cheap to rent, which is why tickets aren't cheap, by the way. I remember one of them saying, "You've never done over 25 minutes of stand-up at once. You can't go out on the road unless you have an hour." That was said to me, and it was right. So I said back, "I know I'm not great, but I will get better." And I said that thinking of my Raging Idiots model of growing into your audience. I said, "I definitely can get a solid hour together." I had trouble convincing some of them, but that's always true. If ever one of my ideas is universally loved, I automatically feel that it's too safe. Something that makes a lot of sense usually means it's safe. I hate safe. My philosophy is that If I'm not afraid of the worst case scenario, failing, why should anyone else be? What do I have to lose by losing? Embarrassment? What I dread more than bombing big time is not taking the shot. You've heard the idea, you don't regret failing as much as you do not trying. As cliche as that sounds, here's the thing about cliches. They exist for a reason. Right now, think of all the things you wish you'd done when you were in college, or a career that you wish you had tried before you started doing what you do now. Those are real regrets. Now, think of a time you made a wrong decision. Those are much easier to digest because you gave it that good old Brady Bunch effort. And it was a learning experience. I don't regret anything I've screwed up. Well, except for being fined $1 million by the FCC. That one stung. My real only regrets are not trying. Not knowing if I have the chops to succeed at comedy doesn't work for me. At least being terrible is closure. At least asking the girl out at the bar, even if she answers, "Nah, I'm not into skinny guys who look like Harry Potter." That's just random, by the way. Yeah. Is better than just wondering what if. So, the percentages and I mapped out the Funny and Alone comedy tour over 30 cities all around the country. We put the tickets for all the cities up at once. There was a lot of pressure in this all-or-nothing approach. If the tour sold terribly, I might have just canceled the entire thing, blaming it on vocal issues or anus replacement. But if it sold really well, I better be freaking funny because people are paying upward of $60 a ticket for me to make them laugh. The day of reckoning arrived. On sale day. Holy crap. I don't know when I felt worse, before or after. The ticket sold. I'd give it a solid 7.5 out of 10 on a scale of first day satisfaction. Now there was no turning back. I had a lot of work left to do. The last thing I wanted to do was disappoint anyone willing to part with their hard-earned money to see me. So I set out to write a longer and funnier set as fast as I possibly could. First, I needed material. I always need material. I host a radio show every day, which is why I'm always taking notes. But I ratcheted up my usual practice of scheduling in hours of writing right after I finish my show. By the way, always put things in a schedule. There will be a terrible case of guilt if you don't get it done, but a cool feeling of accomplishment if you do complete it. Draw a line in the sand with yourself. Just in case I forgot or wanted to forget, I made my lock screen my new goal. I wrote on there, pay attention, be perceptive, and always write it down. That's what I wrote, so I saw it on my lock screen all the time. See it, see it, see it, achieve it. Then I booked small shows in tiny places around Nashville, even multiple small shows a night at a tiny venue. And I did that in order to try out the stuff that I was writing down. I used the people inside as guinea pigs for my new material. Most important, though, was my mental state. I decided I was going to give this tour everything that I had. For months leading up to the start of my national tour, comedy was my life. I was 100% committed after my radio show was over each morning. Despite all of that, to those who came out to my first headlining show in Virginia Beach, I just have one thing to say. Yeah, I'm sorry. First of all, when I took the stage, the theater looked humongous. There were people as far as I could see. In reality, it was about 1,800 people, which in terms of venues isn't all that huge. But when the blood is pumping in your ears and your stomach is doing flips, everything is much bigger and moving so much faster than in reality. I wasn't good. I like nerves, but I let myself get too nervous. I focused on audience members who got up from their seats. When people talked to each other, I imagined they were saying, "What a waste of money." I'm not sure if anybody really talked or got up, by the way. The whole hour was a blur, so nothing I'm reporting has any factual validity. Those might have just been voices in my head saying, "This guy blows." I wish I could blame the whole fiasco on nerves, but I have to be honest with myself. I also had pretty weak material. The weird thing about comedy is that you can't figure out how good your jokes are without an audience. It's not like musicians who can practice songs, licks, and scales over and over and over alone in a room until they've developed the technique and muscle memory to carry them through the jitters of a live performance. As a comedian, you have to take your practice to the people. You're only skilled when you can answer yes to the question, did they laugh? Early in my tour, the answer was, Well, not as much as I'd hoped. When the jokes don't hit, and you've got a room full of people just staring at you, it's worse than getting kicked in the nuts by my dog when I'm sleeping. Much worse. In bed, it's one quick, brutal blow to the nads, and then I'll fall back asleep. Bombing a comedy gig is a sweaty, silent death that will still go on for another 47 minutes. But I'd committed. Not only to the tour, but to getting better. As soon as I got off the stage in Virginia, I didn't talk to anyone or take a moment to feel sorry for myself. Instead, I took my set list of notes and started marking them up. One third gone completely. Cut for total lack of hilarity. Another third got the big needs work mark on it. Then the last third I thought, nah, pretty good. And one night, I went from a solid hour of material to a shaky 20 minutes. That's not the end of the world. There's an old saying that all writing is rewriting. The only problem was that I had another hour to do the next night. But that's why caffeine was invented. I didn't sleep much that night as we made our way to Roanoke, Virginia. Instead, I stayed awake in the van, crossing out a lot more than I was writing. It was 10 a.m. before I stopped scribbling and started having a slight panic attack. By the way, I don't have to drive in a van all through the night and stay at crappy hotels. I'm doing pretty well, but I love chasing the dream so much that the sacrifice of time and quality of life, that didn't even register to me. So load up the van and the trail mix with far too many raisins and not enough chocolate, and let's go grind it out. That was another reason that I knew I had to keep going with comedy. I didn't hate the worst part of it. After sleeping for a few hours, thanks to the generic version of Xanax, I headed over to the venue early. In the theater, I walked around the stage. I sat in the audience's seats. And I did everything that I could think of to get myself comfortable in this new environment. More important, though, I had to get myself comfortable in my own body. I believe that a controlled heart rate is a large key to success, whether it's going to a job interview or giving a speech at a wedding. And this isn't some new age hippy-dippy talk. Think of it this way. Imagine all the times that your heart was beating out of your chest. You probably didn't make the wisest decisions or say the smartest things in that moment. When your body is screaming, I'm freaking out, it's hard for your brain to ignore that. Making nerves work for you. Listen, you're going to get nervous sometimes. It's natural. Everybody gets nervous. I always say nerves are a sign that whatever is happening, good or bad, matters. Usually, the adrenaline gets pumping at a crucial moment, such as asking someone for a raise or out on a date. It's a moment of performance where you have to step up. You're a fighter getting into the ring. Your heart should be beating a little faster than usual, and your senses should be heightened. Those hormones are running through your body to give you laser-like focus. Think of it like that. But if the adrenaline floods your system, and your chest starts banging around like an old radiator in winter, well, you're probably not going to be as effective. You aren't balanced. And balance is what you need to work effectively. When nerves turn into anxiety or even full-blown fear, your brain can't settle down enough to think about your words, your crazy eye twitching, your body language, and anything else you need to put yourself in the best position to succeed. I don't know about you, but I don't work well with my heart pounding through my neck. When I'm anxious, I don't do anything right. I don't think right. I don't speak right. I don't look right. I have a trick, though. When my nerve-zometer starts to veer into the red, take the part of your body wherever it's hitting you the hardest physically, and spread it out from that point throughout the rest of your body. Now, here's my routine. One, I find a quiet, calm place where I can be alone. A bathroom stall even works fine. And then I close my eyes. Even if you can't be alone, take a few seconds wherever you are and just block the world out. Sometimes I just focus on something I really care about that makes me happy, like my dog or Kate Beckinsale. Boom! My second shout out in two books to Kate Beckinsale. Number two. First, I ask myself, is it a good thing that I'm nervous? Usually it is, unless it's a pregnancy scare, but that's been a long time. Most of us get nervous in the face of opportunities that we're worried we're going to screw up. A lot of our nervousness is good. Three, I remind myself that opportunities are awesome. Being nervous at this moment is a byproduct of something great. Four, then I turn the liability of anxiety into the advantage of adrenaline by spreading my nerves from that particular spot through my entire body. I don't put pressure on myself to get rid of the nerves completely. That's not realistic. But I can spread them out.